Accession number 27347, Reel 2.
So we ran Reel 2.
When Dad was demobbed, he brought his new bride up to Middlesbrough. My granny and granddad welcomed her with open arms, and she was immediately one of the family, with sisters and brother in law, who were sisters and brothers in fact. But with only three bedrooms, and there was granny, granddad, Aunt Nellie, Aunt Edie, Aunt Ethel, Aunt Mary, Aunt Nellie, Aunt Lily, Uncle Stan, mother and father who were married, where were they going to sleep? Well, they kept down all over the place, but Dad went out and bought an army bell tent, and they got a local farmer to let them pitch it in his field. When my brother was born a year later, his cot was a drawer out of granny's sideboard with cushions in it. They had a rough time of it. Eventually, they started to build council houses. Teesville was a council estate. And Aunt Edie and Uncle George, Aunt Nellie and Uncle Tom, Mother and Dad, all three got houses on the council estate, and it was the making of them. The family were able to settle down with the unmarried aunties in a fold-away bed in the main bedroom, my Uncle Stan in a tiny little pokey bedroom, box room. And Granny and Grandad had a room to themselves for the first time in years and years and years. The big problem was that Dad and Uncle Stan got a cast iron bath, and they installed it in the kitchen. And they had a wooden platform that they put on top of the bath, so it could be used as a worktop. But every Sunday afternoon, all the aunties wanted baths, and the worktop was taken off. The boiler, which was a cast iron tub, heated from underneath with a coal fire. They used to boil water up in that so that they could have baths. But, of course, being in the back kitchen, it stopped all traffic through. If anybody wanted to go down the yard to the toilet, they couldn't go through here because the aunties were all getting bathed. They had to go right round the block, go out the front door, round the block, and in through the back door, providing nobody had locked the back gate. Then they had to get one of the youngsters to shin over the wall to unlock it. People just don't know how people used to improvise to get round a problem. Now they want it put in their hands. They want it doing for them. They want the council to do it. But in those days, everybody contributed something to the common good in the family. I remember the first... I'm jumping the gun now. Mother and Dad lived in that army bell tent for about 2.5 years before they got the council house. When they got the council house, I suppose it seemed like this is where life starts, and I was born in 1923. But I remember that house very well. My first memory... Oh, sorry, my family have been pushing me to write a book about my whole life. I've written a book about my life during the war, but they want me to do it right from the start. And they asked me what my first memory was. My first memory was in this council house, 9 Lilac Road at Teesville. And there was a young lady lived down the road. I was 4, my first memory. She was about 3 and a half. I'm not going to give her real name because she might still be alive. But I started a jingle. I don't know where I got it from, but I must have heard it somewhere, saying, Eileen Scott has a spot on her bot. And of course, that isn't a real name. Eileen was, but it wasn't Scott. Eventually it came to, no, I haven't. Yes, you have. No, I haven't. Yes, I have. Well, prove it. And she dropped her knickers in the middle of the street. I was 4, she was 3 and a half. And I was seen examining with great interest the difference. Her mother looked out of the window and saw what was happening. And Eileen was dragged indoors. I was shooed away, never to be on these premises again. But I went home and I remember saying to Mum, somebody's cut her willy off. That's my first memory. The family keep telling me I'm not fit to write it in memoirs. But there we are. That's the story. We were about 1.5 miles from the elementary school I was to go to. And it was a case of either walk it or pay a penny full fare or a halfpenny for a child's fare on the Teesside railless traction board trams with an overhead trolley. Most of the time I walked it, 1.5 miles each way, all weathers. I used to take a packed lunch with me, and because Granny lived fairly close to the school, I used to go there with my packed lunch, and Granny would provide a drink, and all the aunties would spoil me and take me back to school. That school has some very happy memories, although it was so primitive. Outside toilets, hard forms. We didn't all have desks. At one time we used to sit at a sloping desk that they'd put along one wall, along one side of the room. I suppose the classrooms were designed for maybe 35 or 40, but as I've said before, there were 56 of us in a class. Toilets, there was always a queue for the toilets. Always a queue. The cloakrooms, I never remember anything ever being pinched in the cloakrooms. We had sometimes we had wellies left in the cloakroom, but they were always there. Mother used to give me a small towel, which I used to hang on my hook, and it never got interfered with, never disappeared. The headmaster was a grumpy old man. And therein lies a tale too. When I was 9, there was what we called the Gasyard Common. It was a place where they used to dump all the ashes from the local gas retorts in the gas yard. And in one corner of this, there was a man who was a builder who had his builder's yard. and he'd fenced it with sleepers horizontally up to a height of about 8 feet. Well, this was a challenge, of course, to people like myself to get over it. I went over it, and on the other side, he had a greenhouse, but there were panes of glass broken in it, and inside were green tomatoes growing. And I'd never seen a green tomato. I knew that tomatoes were always red. So I thought, I wonder if they taste any different to a green tomato. So I reached through the broken glass and helped myself to a green tomato. And I took a bite out of it, and a hand descended on my shoulder. It was the builder. And he marched me through the town, holding the scruff of my neck, up to the police station, and took me in and got me charged with theft. Charged with breaking and entering. Well, they sent for Dad, who was absolutely distraught. There'd never been anything like this in his family. They showed me the cells, and they shut me in a cell while they sent for Dad, just to teach me a lesson, I think. And at the local magistrate's court, I was fined 6 pence with 3 pence costs, and the magistrate ordered that it should be taken out of my pocket money, which was a penny a week. So for 9 weeks I went without anything. It taught me a lesson, but Dad never lived that down, that I should be walked through the town with a man's hand on my collar. But it was a valuable lesson. Anyway, I moved out of that circle by going to the Coatham Grammar School.
At that period when you'd gone to the grammar school, there was the situation occurring in Europe with the rise of the Nazis and Mussolini. Were you aware of that as a schoolboy?
I was aware of it because my brother was in the territorials, and they started training as if he was going to go to war. I used to go and watch them on their parade nights, because I couldn't afford to join the OTC at school, the Officer Training Corps at school, because that needed subscriptions. And if I remember correctly, we had to buy our uniform as well. But I used to watch what they were doing and learn from it. I was very good at map reading, because of my geography at school. And my brother and this friend of his, Les MacFarlane, who's so practical in everything, we used to do all sorts of things which would fit us for going in the army, in the forces.
Which unit was your brother with?
He went in the Royal Army Ordnance Corps, because he'd served his time as a fitter and turner. So ordnance was the way the territorials saw him going. Of course, later on, when Remy was formed, he was transferred to Remy, Electrical Mechanical Engineers.
So you were aware then that the situation was likely to lead to another war?
Yes, my father was particularly conscious of it, and he had a horror of it, because he'd seen Flanders, he'd seen the Italian-Austrian frontier up in the Alps, and yes, he hoped that we would fit ourselves for some job where we'd be essential at home. Because I'd excelled in maths, physics and chemistry, when it came to the crunch and I had to decide whether to go on to university or take a job, I applied to ICI, Imperial Chemical Industries.
So you were making that decision around the time of war being declared?
Yes. It was a reserved occupation, which I didn't want, but it was the field in which I'd excelled at school, the maths, physics and chemistry, and at the local Constantine Technical College we had a degree, a London external degree course for intermediate BSc and then honours BSc. I decided to get myself a job and get my degree through night school, realizing that it was going to be difficult studying at night school, especially when the air raid started. It was a reserved occupation, but because I was dealing with poison gases, I wanted to get the hell out of it. I didn't want to be associated with anything like that. But it was a reserved occupation.
Can I take you back slightly to obviously your results were on the 2nd of September?
Yes.
Do you have any memories of the declaration of war on the 3rd?
Oh, yes, very much so. I was down, staying with my grandmother outside Lewes in Sussex. And I remember listening to the radio, because my brother had got his call-up papers on the Friday before. I got the results on the Saturday, and I was listening to radio, hardly left it, on the Sunday morning. And I remember the sirens going. We thought the air raids would start, because we'd heard a lot about the Spanish Civil War, the German and Italian involvement there, because a lot of left-wing people from Newcastle and Middlesbrough had gone to fight in Spain. Very left-wing, as you can imagine, with so much unemployment, there was a very strong left-wing element where we were, and they were all against the Germans, the Spaniards, and Hitler in particular. They were very, very anti-Nazi and very pro-communist. It had an influence on me. When I was at ICI, my senior staff manager was a communist, and he had quite an influence on me. I began to believe that from each according to his ability and to each according to his need was the nearest thing to Christianity. At the same time, I found the need for some belief, which I hadn't found at our local church. When I was about 14, we got a new vicar, and his first action, surrounded by poverty, his first action was to buy new altar cloths, new robes for the choir, new robes for himself, new carpet to go down the middle of the church. And I left in disgust. I went to the Baptist church because my best pal was went regularly to the Baptist church. I went to the Salvation Army. I went to the Roman Catholic Church. I went to the Seventh-day Adventists. I went to the Wesleyan, the Methodists, and I never found what I was looking for. The nearest I found was the Salvation Army, who would deal with the lowest of the low with no recriminations. Where there was need, they tried to fill it. What I didn't like was their holier-than-thou attitude. maybe I'm being unkind, but I never found what I was looking for.
But at ICI, did you get a growing political awareness then?
Yes, I became very left-wing, but I wanted to get away from the work I was doing at ICI, and I'd always wanted to fly.
Can you tell me about that work?
I'm still aware of the fact that I signed the secrecy papers. I mustn't. It was... there were some sidelines that I was working on, like the hydrogenation of palm kernel oil to make margarine and that sort of thing. But that was that came because of some internal reorganization at ICI. But what I can tell you is that at the age of 17, with Home Guard, fire watching at work, because I had to do fire watching at work because we had so many inflammables in the lab that the local firemen,
the ARP, the
irregulars, couldn't deal with, that we had to do our own fire watching. So I had Home Guard and fire watching. I had night school. I had travelled to and from work on a bike because the buses weren't reliable. I was doing 114 hours a week at the age of 17. I've detailed it all in that book. I mean, people, it's three times what they would expect these days. People just wouldn't work it, but there was a need for it, so we did it.
Can we take some of those and just run through them a little bit? You did, yeah, the fire watching. How was it organised at ICI?
At ICI, I think it was the group leader's secretary had a list of people, and she put the times in that you'd have to do your turn at fire watching, which was from 6 p.m. to 8 a.m. You'd just take over at the end of the work day, and some nights you'd be able to kip on a table in the canteen. Some nights you were active because of incendiaries being dropped. But, yes, you were told when you would go, and it was generally one night a week.
And what would you have to deal with, the incendiaries or bombs at
the... Oh, we had a long-handled scoop. It was like a shovel with the sides turned up, mounted on a pole which was about 10 feet long, and we had a garden rake again mounted on a pole about 10 feet long, and the aim was to scoop an incendiary bomb, which would be burning magnesium, pull it into the turned up sides of the shovel, and get it out through a window into sand. You'd throw a bucket of sand over it. We had a stirrup pump, which was a hand operated pump mounted vertically, and coming out of the body of the pump you had a bracket which went down to the ground with a plate on it that you put one foot on to steady it, and then you worked the pump, and you had somebody else spraying the nozzle. I'm sorry, I forget what the question was. The question was, what equipment did you have? Well, that was it. We had a stirrup pump and a gadget for dealing with incendiaries. Of course, we knew our chemistry. I had a big tub of bicarbonate of soda in case I got sprayed with acid. You never knew. You had to think of what possibilities there were. If the chemical stores had been given a direct hit with a high explosive, it would have scattered such a mixture of chemicals that you'd get all sorts of reactions, all sorts of gases given off. Oh yes, we had a gas mask, but we hadn't much faith in the efficiency of the gas mask. The carbon granules would have only lasted about 7 or 8 minutes with some of the things that we had in the stores. No, it was very by guess and by God and hoping it never happens.
Were there any incidents that occurred while you were fire watching?
Only incendiaries. The main high explosive ones which landed in the main works were dealt with by the works official fire brigade, not by ARP. So I only had incendiaries to deal with.
And were there any specific raids you remember where there were a lot of incendiaries dropped on the factory at all?
Only one, and that was when I was moved to a country house just about 5 miles out of Stockton. Because of the work we were doing, they felt we had to be moved away from the main target, and we were in a country house called Elmwood, which was, I suppose it had about 15 bedrooms and a big dining room, and it had conservatories, and we built huts in the ground. Sorry, I say I built huts in the ground to do some of the more objectionable things. So we were away from the main target, but we still had to do the fire watching.